Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Hello, Scott Tilford.
And only Josh Brown, because it's only me and JB in the studio today, which is why we thought we'd bring back a topic from the good old wind-up that we do every Monday, which is where we pit certain things against each other. Now, we just did a FromSoft ranking, which I recommend you guys go check out. It's me versus Josh on what the best FromSoftware games are from their entire catalogue. And we thought, because we've got a nice excuse for an empty slot, and there's not that much happening in regards to the gaming industry, we do the best PlayStation exclusives pretty much over the last 10 years, although the specific date is going from the beginning of the PlayStation 4's launch day, the specific, that generation, but it is all systems, PS4 games, PS5 games, PS Vita games, PSP games, whatever you want, as long as it was exclusive and remained exclusive. That's the clincher. However, we're not counting the PC.
No.
Because that thing is a rogue element and every single time it comes in and it always affects exclusivity. So just go over there, PC. I don't need you at all. Console exclusivity is what we're talking about. JB, what do you think?
We were kind of spitballing ideas of what to do today, weren't we? We're thinking of maybe doing some news because there is a little bit of news out there. But I think this is going to be spicy because me and you disagree on a lot of things. Yeah. But I think when it comes to PlayStation exclusives, that might be up there with some of the subjects that we just don't see eye to eye on. And I already know, without having seen your ranking, that there's going to be some ridiculous shouts in there that's going to wind me up.
Speaking of ridiculous shouts, let's do our honorable mentions. My first, let me run through these honorable mentions. Now, you don't know what these are, but I know you're going to react to one of them because the top one is The Last of Us 2.
Why?
Yeah, exactly. So let's keep going. My other honorable mentions are Persona 5, Unfinished Swan, Kena Bridge of Spirits, Solar Ash, Ratchet and Clank Rift Apart. I almost said the cheeky one, Rift Apart. No,
Rift
Uncharted Apart. Lost Legacy and Uncharted 4 A Thief's End.
Well, what are yours, sir? I only have one honorable mention. I kept this lean, and that is Resident Evil 7 Biohazard, the VR edition. That did stay PSVR exclusive as far as I'm aware, as
it's very good.
Least of my research 5 minutes ago. You've got some insane ones on there. A lot that's in my main list.
I knew they would
which
be.
Is, which, of course it
so
is.
So it's worth also clarifying that these are entirely subjective lists.
Yes.
These are always fun to put together because it's literally just what is entirely my opinion, not worrying about giving review scores or anything even close to the idea of objectivity and is this game an opulent, brilliant thing, product, whatever, to give to people, just subjectivity. I didn't put The Last of Us in the top 10 because I just ultimately don't rate it that highly. I didn't need it. It's an unnecessary sequel for just little old me, and I was better off without it, to be honest, even though I love playing through it and it's a 5-star game. Point being that my number 10 is Final Fantasy VII Remake, but only on the hard mode, because only the hard mode is where everything changes. It's where all the mana stuff changes, all the different MP allocations and the ways that you only have certain amounts of spells per chapter, and that means that you have to rethink the way that you approach bosses, fights themselves. You have to ration out different spells and different approaches to combat, and it's a lot more like the original Final Fantasy VII in terms of the mentality you need to have to get through it. And I just like that game obviously has a bunch of problems in regards to like changing things up, like Sephiroth's introduction, the way that they handle the villains and the pacing and everything else. But for me, when I went through it on hard mode, I was like, this really clicked. This brought the sort of like the chess, like the combat, like the depth to the combat that I kind of wanted. And you know, you can just enjoy all the remix sound, the soundtrack and all the different approaches that they had to just applying a humongous budget to this thing that initially was given to a one-man translation team back in the day.
It's funny when it comes to Final Fantasy VII Remake, because that's one of the only games I've known you to go platinum mad for.
Yes.
Like, I don't know if
I
you guys...
I have like four platinums in my life, and that's one of them.
Totally. I don't know if you guys listening know, but it's very rare that Scott like pursues a platinum if you're not fully into a game. And I remember you putting like hundreds of hours into that title. Final Fantasy VII Remake is one that I ummed and ahed about putting on my own list. It's actually not on there, but I will throw it in as an honorable mention because it does so much, especially for a new time Final Fantasy fan, which I totally was. You know, I knew, you know, some of the beats from the original game, but I was going in mostly fresh, having no connection to those characters. And it absolutely got me in a way that a Final Fantasy game just hadn't before. The reason it didn't make it on my list is just because of the downsides that you mentioned there.
The ending's absolute insanity as well.
I like the ending.
No, I love it, but it's insanity. Like, it's full on Tetsuya Nomura Kingdom Hearts madness, and chances are they'll never be able to capitalize on it.
Considering how safe so many remakes are, I was so blown away at how bonkers Final Fantasy VII Remake got, and that's why I hold it quite dear.
It's like, it's this weird living conversation with the Final Fantasy VII fandom, as it this weird cottage industry that, you know, the way Square Enix treats the Final Fantasy VII IP in all of its weird forms. There's going to be a battle royale later this year and whatever else. And that's, it has this weird intrinsic quality to it that makes it unique, even though it is a remake, but secretly it's a sequel. And that's kind of the thing with it. That's kind of just fascinating to watch unfold. It is meant to be coming to Xbox. It's been meant to be coming to Xbox for the last 2 years.
Yeah.
So right now it is still exclusive. And I honestly kind of think that deal's just not going to come together. Because they keep pushing it back or delaying it or just never addressing it. But whatever, it's an exclusive for now. What's your top 10? What's your number 10?
My number 10 is Uncharted 4, which almost didn't make it on the list. It was almost an honorable mention, like you said. But when it comes to Uncharted 4, like, this was a game that kind of got me into Uncharted. I played the other titles, and I was like, these are pretty good. I didn't play them at the time.
Right.
I didn't play Uncharted 2 when it first came out. I played it with the Nathan Drake collection that came to PlayStation
4. No way! Okay.
Yeah, so it was really late. And I enjoyed them enough, but I played them after I played The Last of Us, which kind of spoiled me a Naughty Dog, because I was just thinking, right, this is the bar, and I went back to them. But Uncharted 4, you know, kind of lived up to the spectacle of The Last of Us in terms of its storytelling and characters, and it was an emotional send-off to the series. It's not higher on my list, because I do think it has some pacing issues, which a lot of Sony exclusives I noticed have, looking back on them, especially in, like, the early parts of Uncharted 4. You know, it takes a while to get into the action, it's a bit elongated in the end, but to me, it's still an impeccable exclusive, and I think it holds up, you know, all of these years later, almost 10 years later in a way, or whatever it is.
Yeah, I mean, when I started putting this list together, Uncharted was on there. However, I've always maintained that Lost Legacy is a better game, like as an overall package, and Lost Legacy was in my top 10 as well, and it was only as I started filling things up and being subjective AF that I started sliding things back. Uncharted 4 was meaty as hell. It's just that ultimately it's kind of just more Uncharted. I do like the level of, you know, it works better if you grew up with the franchise because it is Nathan Drake growing up as a character, and they do that whole meta connection thing. And I love him putting all of the paraphernalia, all the ephemera of the other adventures in his basement. Like, he's locked them away out of his mind. And it's like, he has to discover that he can be an adventurer and he can fall in love with someone and they can share with everything. And I was like, this is such a good growing up lesson. Like, find someone who digs the stuff you dig.
What I love is that it's a game that manages to be mature and emotional without being dark or gritty. Like, it's a darker Uncharted compared to the other games, but it's not a game that revolves around people dying or, you know, extreme violence or whatever. It's just about this one dude, like you said, kind of reckoning with his past and trying to grow up in a way and become more than just the adventurer he's known for. And I think that's just a really neat story to tell in a game that is obviously, you know, Naughty Dog level when it comes to the attention of detail, and it's beautiful and it's bombastic.
The thing they do as well that, like, it doesn't get enough credit is the fact that because they write Nate Drake in Uncharted 4 so grounded, and they make him such a person, he's sitting there doing his taxes and working out his bills, and he's sitting there having that breakfast in the morning, it retro retroactively makes all the risks that he took in the other in the trilogy way more effective. Like, and also Golden Abyss on the Vita, but things like that. I remember just thinking that I was like, man, you were really taking that big jump. You were really leaping across that chasm. Like, it sort of retroactively made me want to go back and do all those adventures again. I know they weren't planning it that way initially, but there's something about really grounding the person that kind of makes him like all those stumbles and all the like, oh crap, and all that kind of stuff. It's like that works even better now. My number nine is Until Dawn. Because
my number nine is Until Dawn.
Because it's a beautiful, beautiful, perfect game.
Come on, the boys.
I love the boys. Until Dawn. The thing is, it's some of these games, it's making me think of lists, like games that are best first time through or better games you had to play at launch or something like that. Until Dawn, the first time you go through it, because it is so choice-based and so rewarding in that regard. And the thing is, like in gaming, slasher horror is never, very rarely done.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Dead by Daylight's kind of got it, but even that is like that asymmetrical multiplayer, same with Friday the 13th, but you very rarely get to, you know, really enjoy like a slasher teen horror style setup. And Until Dawn is just putting you in the middle of one of those teen horror films and letting you make those decisions and not go down the dark corridor in the room or whatever. And it's like, and it adapts to every single one of them. And obviously there's loads of different ways the game can finish depending on how much of your team survive or whatever. And I love the structure of that thing. And Peter Stormare's character is brilliant.
Yes.
The extra dimension they do with the storytelling where, you know, you keep cutting to this dude in the future who's in therapy, and it's like, well, which one of the crew makes it out? Who goes to therapy? That stuff's really cool. It's not like an all-star cast, but you've got, you know, Hayden Panettiere and Rami Malek, and like this, it's really, really cool.
Yeah, it's totally like, you know, a cast of people who would go on to like do big things. Like you said, Rami Malek obviously going on to star Mr. Robot, going on to be in Bohemian Rhapsody, yeah, like gaining all of this acclaim and stuff. And you go back to this game, this odd idiosyncratic game that is a love letter to slasher movies, like you mentioned. You've got all of these actors in there, like, you know, doing really good work. Mm-hmm. For me, it's the best Supermassive Games game that they have released. I just think it's the most
by far,
complete and the most fully formed.
The one they're going back to with The Quarry, in theory.
100%. And, you know, the way it throws in not just those slasher tropes and aesthetics, but, you know, everything from creature features to Saw-esque traps, you know, it really does pull from a lot of different horror influences and plays them well. It's not just a kind of a homage fest or a stitching together of a bunch of cliches and tropes. Like, it's a well-told story in and of itself. The characters are interesting, and the amount of control you have over them, I always think, is amazing. You might not be able to branch off the story in incredibly radical different ways, although there are
obviously branching paths. It feels like you can.
It feels like you can. And the way you can control each character's personality means that each one can be, you know, more of a dick if you want them to be more of a dick, or nicer depending on kind of what you want. In playing that game either solo or in a group of friends at a, you know, at a party or a sleepover or what have you, it's always fun. It always elicits so many, you know, good reactions. And I think graphically and presentationally, it still holds up now.
Oh, totally, man. And plus, like, I mean, you've got like all these like really fun stereotypes, archetypes, like the jock, the cheerleader, whatever, that like, yeah, you get to control. And also because you really start caring about those characters when some creature or whatever, the killer in the house, whatever it is, comes after you, and you do have to like hold the controller completely steady. Like that, like you care if you're going to mess up. And it's like, that's such a unique horror-based feeling that no other game really does.
100%. And that's one of my favorite quick time events in the game is whenever it makes you hold the controller still. I think the characters are, you know, trying not to breathe or whatever to alert the monsters and the killer. And I always mess it up. My hands shake so much in that moment that I always get someone killed. So I like that it incorporates, you know, all the features of the dual shock. And I can only hope that, you know, something like The Quarry or whatever the team does next incorporates the dual sense in a more immersive way to make those QTEs even better.
I don't know if Until Dawn is on the PlayStation Plus collection. If it's not, I mean, just in general, if you're remotely into horror games, you're remotely into the idea of branching story paths and just a good, well-crafted game with good acting and storytelling and great reveals, like tons of great reveals as it goes, play Until Dawn. It's brilliant. Number eight, again, subjective AF, but I adore this game, is The Last Guardian. The Last Guardian so much. It's the only game that's ever, ever, ever done the relationship between a person and a dog, or a person and a cat. A person, like, you know what it's like if you grew up with them. Did you grow up with pets?
I didn't.
Right, so if like people who grow up with pets, obviously you have to teach them and you want to, like, you know, learn, like, you need to like discipline them in certain ways, and you feel affection in a very specific way. It's obviously why we love animals so much, and no game's ever nailed that. Like, Fable 2 got close, well-ish, with the dog, where you didn't have any direct control over it, and you could kind of intuit things from it. But the thing that I love about The Last Guardian was just that barely describable connection that you have with an animal where it knows what you're thinking and you know what it's thinking and you have some ways to tell it what to do. But there's a certain level of patience you have to have with the creature that you're looking after, Trico. And it's all about like, you know, telling it where to go. And like, and at the beginning, it's not listening to you very much.
Yeah.
And it's just, and it, you build this great relationship with it where like you're just one by the end. And I just, they just nail that relationship where like the two of you are escaping this like ancient stone, like location, whatever it is that the creature is imprisoned. You're imprisoned and you have to work together to get out. And by the time you get out and you're like it can't even fly at the beginning and you're both like soaring through the air and stuff or making the big final leaps and everything. I just, there's not been a connection like that. And I was just like, it's literally humans and animal connection, the game.
Totally.
I love it.
I've not actually played it myself. Oh. I've always said that I wanted to, but it's exactly what you just mentioned there. That's been the most appealing thing for me. Mm. And what's always kind of made me gravitate towards it, even if I haven't taken the dive, it is the idea of when it first came out, you know, it had so much criticism thrown at it that the creature, the beast wouldn't like follow your orders. And stuff,
people would spam the moves, and I was like, it's because it's, give it a minute. Yeah. It needs to figure out what you want.
Totally. But to me, from exactly what you just mentioned there, like that seems like an integral part of the bonding experience that you have this unwieldy thing that you grow to love and grow to have this connection with, where eventually, you know, you're telling them to do stuff and then they're actually responding like a part of you, you know?
Yes, like a limb. My favorite thing as well, it was the moment that I fell in love with it when I first played through it back in 2016, is like you do things where maybe you clamber up a ledge or something and you'll kind of watch Trico sort of watch you a little bit, cocks its head to the side, same way a cat would or a dog would, and it's like sizing up, like, can I make that jump? And you kind of like, your guy kind of does the, come on then, come on, you can do it, and it leaps up and you get such a like, good boy, like, go on, you've done it. And it's just, it's exactly what you have with a dog or a cat or whatever, when it does, you know, either have its own agency or does what you want, there's little bits where it syncs up. No other game's ever done that, and because it is in this big like fantastical kind of space and you do want to escape together but you do want to bond together, and you get all these really cool animations where, you know, it'll snatch you out the sky when you're about to fall or something like that, it's just a really, really, really great game. I love The Last Guardian so much. I obviously admit that the biome diversity is the one thing that it falls down on, because it was this put back together game that was delayed for so long. It was meant to be part of the trilogy with Ico and Shadow of the Colossus, and then eventually it was kind of resurrected and pumped life back into. And Fumito Ueda, I think that was his name, Ueda, you know, said, we did our best kind of thing and whatever. But I adore it. It has an intrinsic quality that just nothing else has come close to. What's your number 8?
It is Horizon Forbidden West.
Forbidden West!
Recent
what?
Game on this list.
But that's the worst one, Josh.
It's not the worst one. It's better than the original. I've had time to think and ruminate on this sequel since it came out, since we played Elden Ring, since I did my From Software binge.
Yes.
And the further I get away from it, I thought I would forget about it. Mm. But I actually appreciate it more now I've had time to think back on it. I just think it takes what the original did gameplay-wise, knocks it up to another level. I think the amount of detail in the game is incredible. The amount of side content in there that's varied and original is awesome. Yes, the main story isn't as good as it could be.
Yep.
It does fall down a little bit in the end. But as an open world game, as a sandbox game, I would say you'd be difficult to find anything or much more that rivals its level of quality on the current generation. There's stuff like Red Dead Redemption 2. There's stuff like other things that I've got on this list. Mm. But I think it's in the top tier of open world games, man. I really do.
I largely only disagree. I think Forbidden West drops the ball in almost every regard. I think the story is incredibly unrewarding. It completely falls apart at the end, and all the open world stuff felt like busy work. When you said that you had, I mean, you did way more of it than me, because I just had to tap out at some point. I was like, none of this stuff matters and I don't care. I have Zero Dawn further down my list because I think it's just a much better game overall.
Right.
And the story pull is there, the character work is there. Yeah, I think Forbidden West is such a worse sequel, but that's a whole other subjective thing. Like, there's obviously big positives to Forbidden West. It's very immaculately made. But yeah, I would largely contest everything you've said.
Listen, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. And I want to direct people to the podcast we did on this game earlier in the year.
Yes.
We have talked about this game at length, but I just kind of wanted to put it in here and say that with the 2 months or whatever distance from that title, it's done enough for me to be better than Until Dawn and Uncharted 4, which kind of seems mad. And I might go back on that by the end of the year. But right now, that's the space it occupies.
Forbidden West is, yeah, it's a lot of stuff to go and do. And it does that stuff very well. I was just bored by it. I didn't think it nailed the stuff. And like, I'll get back to this, the why Zero Dawn's better in my eyes. As we go, you don't have anything else you want to say about Forbidden West?
I think that's fair.
Number 7 is Sifu. I think Sifu is a refined, I think it's immaculate. Like, I think is Like, give me a flaw. Give me a single pixel out of place in that game.
I mean, to be honest, I couldn't. And it certainly wouldn't be on my list, but really? I want to know why it would be on yours, Scott Hill.
Mine, I think it's like it replicates the idea of learning a martial art in video game form. Like, you have to steel yourself, you have to do certain things over and over again. And there's something about Sifu, the brutality of it, the viscerality of it, that is deploying a martial art. And there's an intrinsic, like, I keep using the word intrinsic, but it's that core feeling when you get good at a game or a certain set of systems and they're in you and you don't realize that you've actually learned it, muscle memory, and it's like in a digital space. And so Sifu for me, it is like a clenched fist kind of other game. And it's just like when you go back through those levels and you deploy the things you've learned. And also the world itself, I think, is so rewarding and deep. Like, I love the story they tell. There's a very surface level version of it that you can just burn through. I know you got through it a lot faster than I did, and but that's the whole thing. The longer I spend in those levels, and the more things that I unlocked, and the more the Sifu themselves is, you know, finding out what's going on in the world around them and the different connections between the bosses. And why those different areas exist and how they link to each other. There's just little drips of like Streets of Rage in there, and like in terms of how the environments connect and stuff. And I just think that it's that extra layer of rewarding on top of, you know, mastering this combat system that is in itself just so stupidly satisfying.
I mean, I get that totally. It's definitely going to be my game of the year list come the end of this year, I imagine, because like you said, you know, it has a set of mechanics, it has a flow to its combat that just gets in you. You know, when I was playing that game, I literally had to take a break from Forbidden West because I just wanted to live on Sifu. I just wanted to live in that world and batter all of those guys until they were dust. For me, the issue is I would have enjoyed this game if you were literally just a mesh of a character model, if you were just a character model mesh, if you were just a stick man with the same combat system.
You need to play Absolver because you're going to describe Absolver.
Right, yeah. I would have enjoyed it the most. If it looked like super hot, I wouldn't have felt like anything was missing. To me, you know, the story and the characters, it just felt like kind of surface set dressing, like you said, which
it's definitely optional. Yeah.
I didn't dive too much into the story and stuff, but for me, there was nothing pulling me into it. The secrets I was checking out, you know, I was going rerunning levels to find those hidden doors, those hidden secrets and stuff, but those connections I just wasn't really interested in making. They didn't jump out to me in that way. So I thought the combat was great. It was just everything else where I was thinking, this is good. Don't get
well, the thing is, like, but that is entirely fair. I just, for me, it was always like, why am I respawning? How am I able to come back from the dead? Am I coming back from the dead? Or is this a video game thing where we're restarting? Why are characters referencing the fact that there's immortality in this world? And I was like, that's just so cool. And then picking that apart and realizing that you can use the time bending stuff to like take a key card from the fourth level and then bend back to level one and put that in a door, which then, you know, uncovers a relationship between two of the bosses. And it's like, that's so cool.
Yeah.
So I loved all that stuff and found it to be very, very rewarding. What is your number 7?
Ghost of Tsushima.
Oh, that's a lot higher for mine.
Is it really?
Yeah, hell yeah.
Well, the thing about Ghost of Tsushima is it was way, way better than I expected it to. I bought this game actually kind of not even intending to finish it. I wasn't like completely blown away by the trailers. I thought it looked good.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to be okay. I thought it was going to be slightly better than Days Gone. I could not believe how much I loved it by the end. You know, it's an open world game, again, of the very top tier, in my opinion. The world itself, the characters, the story are all great, rivaling the likes of, you know, a Naughty Dog game in terms of storytelling, in my opinion. The combat is absolutely sick, a step above what developers Sucker Punch had accomplished before. It's all incredible. It's only let down to me by a few archaic design choices, you know, some of the repeated side missions, you know, getting to the shrines, looking at the foxes, some repeated environments, you know, the interior of a lot of the buildings quite clearly copied and pasted and stuff. And like, it's all kind of really small minor issues. I think it's an amazing like 9 out of 10 game. But when I play Ghost of Tsushima, I think it's amazing, but I also, I'm more looking forward to the sequel because I just think that will be...
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
If they get it right, the perfect game.
Well, as you remember, when we both went through Ghost of Tsushima at the same time, you played it in a very specific order, which you can absolutely argue is the way you're supposed to play it. However, I would argue that you can go into that game and pick a bunch of different directions, and the game writes itself around that. Doesn't matter which order of people you meet in terms of the NPCs, the side characters and stuff. Even by the end, you can do the final mission and then still have other quote-unquote main characters left over, and the dialogue will reference that. So I just went through Ghost of Tsushima. I didn't notice the duplicate stuff because I just did whatever came to mind as I went. And I'm talking a lot. I'm going to use Intrinsic for the last time. But my point is that all of my picks, the vast majority of my picks have an extra like quality to them that I feel like is this digital incarnation of a certain feeling or a certain thing that you can't get anywhere else. That's why I love video games so much anyway. But in terms of Ghost of Tsushima, it has that feeling of like tranquility and serenity that I get from Japanese artwork or Japanese architecture or the landscape or whatever. So I love Japan anyway, and I'm probably planning to go later this year. But there's something about that feeling, and then they translate that into the combat, and they do this whole thing of like, you know, becoming this sort of demonic version of himself to save the beautiful thing. And I was like, that's so compelling. And like, what is wrong with my throat?
Dude, you're just so emotional.
I am. And that's like so compelling. And there's all that stuff where, you know, I mean, I took up the shakuhachi wind instrument after playing it in this game. And just, there's something about that game where the haikus and playing the shakuhachi is you're just walking, seeing this beautiful space around you. And I know that it's Japan viewed through a Western lens, and there's been conversations around that, largely positive. But that just enraptured me in a way that made me put it at my number three.
Wow.
But we'll get there in good time. Number six for me. Now, this is a question. Is Spider-Man and Miles Morales, can they be put together, or should we separate?
I
will understand either.
I'm feeling generous. Mm. I would say you can put them together. Okay. I think that's fine.
Right, so number six, if we're putting them together, it's Spider-Man and Miles Morales. If you want me to pick one, it's just Spider-Man.
Yes,
although
yeah, I would agree.
Miles Morales is a tighter game, but it is glorified DLC.
Yes.
But either way, the Spider games, they're just immaculate. Although they do, you can see what they're pulling from. It's the Arkham combat system. It's the swinging system for Spidey 2. But nothing had done that in so long. That I just had an absolute blast as Spidey. I still maintain that it's very safe game design, bankable game design, which has made them an absolute mint in regards to the sales and everything. It's supposed to be quite a short entry because I just think that everyone's played Spider-Man. You know why it's great. It is the swinging combat system. It doesn't have that core extra layer thing that I'm referencing with other games, but it just is a very good Spider-Man game. And as someone who grew up watching Spidey, who loves the character, I think they nailed it in terms of the act and the cutscene direction, the cinematic side of it. Which twinned with the gameplay was just really, really solid.
100%. It's not my number six, but it is my number five. So
very
I might
nice.
As well talk about it right now, because
yes.
I agree with everything you've just said. You know, gameplay-wise, it just refines aspects that previous Spider-Man games have already introduced and popularized. Mm. But for me, the main draw is the story. You know, as a big Spider-Man fan, it was so fascinating to see Insomniac draw from eras of the comics that a lot of the Spider-Man media these days, especially in the movie universe, universe doesn't really draw from, you know, put their own spin on villains, the timeline, etc., and have a older Peter Parker, which is something that I normally don't necessarily love that.
Parker is my favorite Peter Parker.
Sometimes an older Peter Parker, they get wrong because they make him rich or they kind of make him like a CEO or something. And for me, I do like the idea of a grown-up Peter Parker, you know, in his late 20s, kind of having trouble with MJ, trying to get out of, you know, being a kid and then becoming a mentor to Miles as he does properly in the DLC and taking responsibility for the likes of Aunt May and stuff. And I just thought the characterization of those characters, whether it was Miles, whether it was Peter, whether it was MJ, whether it was Aunt May, were all so well drawn in a way that, you know, something like the Avengers just absolutely wasn't.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just that they put their own spin on it. It was that all the actors brought their A game. It was written into a really compelling story with an emotional gut punch of an ending. And it established a world, a confident world that I just think will support so many games going forward. And I can't wait to see how this Spider-Man in particular develops and grows and what we get next.
Yeah, man. Well, that's the thing. I agree with every single part of that. And I love just going through it. You made such a good point about career Spidey, because animated Spider-Man, the old Fox show, is my favorite Spider-Man incarnation ever. And it's just, it was like a playable version of that. Like, you know, give him enough responsibility, give him enough familial ties to sort of get, you know, to be interrupted by the villains or whatever other things come along. It's just a great version of that fiction, and arguably the best digital version of that fiction that we've ever got.
I'd say so.
Yes. So that was your number five. My number six was Spidey. My number five is Horizon Zero Dawn, which, and we'll not talk too much about Horizon because we talked about Forbidden West before, but the thing that just elevates, I love the Horizon fiction and I love it more in Zero Dawn. They do more with it, I feel. And it was the introduction to that fiction that they just nailed. Like every single question you had about what was happening with the dinosaurs and what was happening, you know, with the world design. Why was there such a lack of knowledge? Why did people, this tribe, the Nora tribe, that value motherhood above all else, and they, you know, they call, you know, they cast Aloy out and all these kind of things. I think that's so much more rich, and I think that's so much more, it's such a better driving plot point and narrative structure than Forbidden West. Like it's all those things that I think Forbidden West drops, and it's because Zero Dawn is so meaty and it's such a great first installment, and they're so confidently going like, well, here's the answer to this, here's the answer to this, this is why this is this, that Forbidden West didn't have anything to go from, and it was why I dropped off Forbidden West, or I do drop off Forbidden West as it went on, because it just couldn't keep up the fascination aspect. And obviously in Forbidden West they lean into all these Kryptonian superhuman things, which whatever, not getting any more specific than that, but that wasn't anywhere near as compelling as what is the ground beneath my feet in Zero Dawn, and how do I fit into this world, and Aloy's journey. My favorite, if we ever did, we should do a debate, the best scenes, individual scenes,
right,
character scenes, in PlayStation games or video games or whatever. And I've said this before, but it's the one where she comes back to the tribe and she still doesn't have a mother or anything, but her face activates something, and all the tribe who hated her, this whole comment, like, you know, bullies being fickle and everything, they all just start worshipping her. And I love the way she dresses them down. It's my favorite thing. I just love that scene so much. So it's, yeah, I love the first Horizon way more than Forbidden West.
I would agree with you on your points there, to be fair. I think that the first game definitely has a better story. It definitely has kind of like better characterization and better arc overall. I just suppose I wasn't as enamored with that story as you were. And when it came to the second game, it was the gameplay that got me into those two titles in the first place. I do think the first Horizon holds up massively well from a gameplay perspective. You know, going to that before Forbidden West came out, I couldn't believe how fluid and smooth that felt, even though we're 5 years on, we've had a whole new console since then. So I do think it is something that you should play now. Like, don't think of it as an old game. It's not old game.
Especially on PS5, it has the 60 FPS, the 4K stuff. Like, it's the Decima engine. And speaking of the Decima engine...
Whoa, hang on. Let's go back, because we actually skipped my number six.
Did I?
And I won't say it. I won't go into too much, but it's six. I had Returnal. I've talked about this game to death.
Please do.
So many podcasts about this. This was the game that got me into roguelikes. And I love it. I love it so much. That was my number six. I'm going to leave it at that.
Are you sure? You can absolutely talk more about it. I jumped right over Returnal.
My friend, it is totally fine. I hope someone would check out the other podcast we've done on this, because we talked about this almost nonstop last year.
There is that.
I also did a review of it on the main channel, which my thoughts are mostly the same. If you do
just
want to check
it
out on YouTube.
That you ruddy loved Returnal. Yes. I absolutely did not, but it's a pristine clockwork of a game.
Yeah.
And I think that, there's a lot of systems to get stuck into if they do click with you. That was a bit of a jumble thing. Your number six was Returnal.
That's it, yeah.
And then your number five was Spidey.
Totally.
Whereas my number six was Spidey and my number five was Horizon Zero Dawn, which brings me to number four, Because speaking of the Decima engine, it's Death Stranding.
Ooh.
Because this shuffled around a lot. And it's I said this, I've been saying this since 2019. If that game wrapped tighter, the whole thing would be a 5-star, the best thing I've ever played. But going through that game was infinitely more fun than the narrative side of it. And it's that the narrative side of it, the storytelling side of it, the literal script, whatever, the acting, the line delivery, everything in that regard is a garbage fire for the most part, especially at the end. And so I'm not going to dog on it too much because it's still number 4 on my list because of how well it plays and how rewarding it is and how great the unlocks are and the fact they give you all these different systems to overcome a 3D space, which is a whole separate thing. It's something that Breath of the Wild kind of tapped into. It's like, you know, defeating a 3D space is something that we just got away from in the 2000s.
Yeah.
But Tomb Raider used to do that stuff so much. So yeah, Death Stranding is just this immaculate set of gameplay systems that drops down in my numbers just because the story side of it is absolute awesome.
And I get it. It's my number 2. I think it's incredible. I went back through it again last year and had an even better time than the first time I went through it, which is impossible because the first time
we lost you for a week when you were playing that.
Oh man, I was obsessed with it. You talked about games previously that have this intrinsic quality that gets in you, that gets you into a certain headspace, into a certain aesthetic sensibility. For me, Death Stranding is that all over. Like you said, the gameplay itself is so Moorish, you know, the lack of combat, but the commitment to conquering a landscape, you know, mastering the nature itself, the environment itself, is something that few games do as good as this, you know, just building roads. I could spend tens of hours building roads in this game.
Well, the thing that I remember when they came out and I was like, you guys have not mismarketed it, but you missed out the best selling point, which is that feeling you get when you and a bunch of complete strangers build something together.
Yeah.
Where, like you said, you have a bunch of resources on you, crafting components, if you want to call them that, and you arrive at a place, a road that's like semi-built, and there's another road way over in the distance that seems like it could probably connect. And you do that, and you know that you've just helped about 50,000 other people's save files, now they can get there.
Totally.
And that was the Strand genre that Kojima was getting at, which I think barely came through in the marketing. But there's such an insanely rewarding feeling to all working together. And you can also, like, there's a button you can have, I think it's the touchpad, to ping the world and see if anyone else is standing where you're standing in the same space in their save. And if that someone else does that, you'll hear like a sound and stuff. But there's a collective community building aspect to Death Stranding, conquering that space together, whether it's zip lines or roads or stunt ramps in the re-release. That stuff, that's the extra layer. Like, that's so good.
100%, man. Like, I don't care about Instagram likes, I don't care about Twitter likes, but I do care about my Death Stranding likes. I care about them so much. They don't make any sense. You just whack that button.
Yep.
But like you said, that sense of community that you get, even though you don't meet any other players in the flesh, is just so rewarding. You know, the way that game and the world is put together is so rewarding, and I fully agree that, you know, the story itself goes some places, I will say, to be polite, and it doesn't always hit, and there is a pacing issue at the end. However, while the storytelling might not be all that great, I do think the mythology is awesome, like the lore of that game, the world that Kojima spins.
The questions he's posing are fun to talk about.
The Death Stranding itself, I just think is a fascinating concept, and it frees up that game for so many inventive set pieces and time blending images and stuff. And it's just one of those games where I look at it and I think, I would watch this as a movie. I would read this book. I would look at the art all day long. Ooh. It just has one of those worlds that hits all my buttons.
I definitely think that it needs to be played to like click. Although I know what you mean in terms of the wider lore stuff. It's like, if you like your art, if you like your auteurs as just, you know, like, I want to look into this person's mind and see what they've put together, which, by the way, go see The Northman. That thing is literally Mr. Robert Eggers' mind sprayed out into a fantasy setting. Saw it last night. It's very good. But overall, in terms of Death Stranding, it's very much a window into Kojima's mind, the amount of research he's done into the history stuff. And not to dwell this point too much, but it reminded me of when the Metal Gear in Metal Gear 5 was just called Sahelanthropus.
Yeah.
And it was like, what the hell is that, Kojima? So I Googled it, and it's like, okay, that is one of the oldest fossils that we ever found. And all the stuff to do with the extinction events that's talked about in here is true. It's all from actual human history. Which is just kind of fascinating in itself. What's your number 4?
My number 4, potentially contentious, is God of War.
My God. My own God.
The thing is, with God of War, I would recommend this thing to anyone. I think it's an immaculate 9 out of 10 game. I love the story. I love the gameplay. But you're talking about those extra elements, you know, that get in you.
Yes.
And for whatever reason, God of War just didn't have loads of those. It's an experience that I love when I'm in it. Mm-hmm. I like talking about it. I want to see what happens next with God of War Ragnarok. It got me into Norse mythology in a way that I never thought I would ever care about. But if I'm looking at the things that are above it, it didn't live in me in the same way.
I think that comes from the fact that I think you played the earlier ones after the 2018 one?
Let me say this, though. That is,
I'm going to go down that subjective route entirely.
100%. Yeah. That is true. I did play... This was my first God of War, essentially.
Exactly.
I dabbled in the others. But since then, I have played all the other God of Wars and gone back to it.
Okay.
In my opinion, didn't really change that much.
It's weird, because I'll talk about God of War when I get to it in my list, because I'm going to hang this on a very subjective thing.
Right.
But like, yeah, I'll get to that.
Okay.
Because we can revisit God of War. My number three is Ghost of Tsushima. We talked about that before.
Yes.
So we can jump past that one. What's your number three?
Bloodborne.
Oh! Bloodborne isn't even on my list.
Is better than God of War. Just... entirely, purely subjective.
Doing a wide-eyed face over here.
Because it has those extra elements that I personally love. You know, it's got all of the horror influences from Bram Stoker stuff to Lovecraftian nightmares. I think the way it weaves its story is fascinating. And replaying it recently, I got way more of the story than I ever did before.
Right.
I love the gameplay changes that it makes from Dark Souls, making it more aggressive. The rally system where you can get health back if you're more aggressive and you hit enemies just after you being hit is awesome. It's faster, it's more aggressive. It's the full package, and I now want a Bloodborne 2.
It's your Sifu.
It is my Sifu, some would say. And when I look at kind of God of War compared to Bloodborne, you know, I don't really want to get into that too much because this is entirely subjective. I think God of War is a more complete mechanical game, you know. This is good. I'm saying God of War is better here.
God of War
is more complete. It is more reliably good. It doesn't have the same lows of Bloodborne. But for me, Bloodborne has the higher highs.
I don't know why, but my brain heard that as Bloodborne is more mechanically...
The worst case scenario.
I'm completely ill. I've been playing too much Sonic. This is the brain's gone. Bloodborne, I'm going to revisit it once they release the 60fps patch, because I'm going to just try it again. We talked about this in the From Software video, but that thing just didn't click with me at all. It wasn't even one of my honorable mentions, which I know is... I get it. All the people tweeting me, I know. It's a thing. But Bloodborne didn't click with me. What did click with me at number two is Astro's Playroom.
Really?
Yes.
Astro's Playroom.
If I could swear on this podcast, absolute effing lutely. Astro's Playroom is one of the most pristine things you can experience as a gamer. Now, you have to be a PlayStation gamer. You have to have someone who grew up with PlayStation.
Yeah.
But that thing is a playable just trip through entire PlayStation history. It's so meticulous. It's so well made. Like, if we're talking like animations and the way that it feels to control that character, all the stuff they do with the DualSense is nice icing on the cake in terms of the fact that the sand feels different to ice, feels different to water and whatever. And the amount of Easter eggs that they throw in there, whether it's clouds, a little version of Astro Cloud, the little sword, or Resident Evil, or The Last of Us, or whatever. It's like playing PlayStation history. All the sound effects are in there from the PlayStation 2 boot up sequence or the PS1 or whatever it is. And I just grinned ear to ear. And I was like, I know that this is meant to be it's like a tech demo type thing for what the PS, for the DualSense can do, but it just nails it all. And if I'm going to go, my overall thing is always, what were they going for and what did they nail? They nailed every single part of it.
Well, the thing is, I love you, Scott Silver, and I agree with everything that you just said about this game in particular, but number two, above The Last of Us, which didn't even get on the list, above Death Stranding.
I like games that needed to exist.
Bloodborne.
Yeah.
Did Astro's need to exist? Did it? I don't know if that's true, man. I don't know if that's true.
Astro's Playroom has more permanence than The Last of Us 2.
That is, if you weren't my friend... I would leave this room, but you are. So I'm married into this.
Yeah, you're married into this. What was the thing you said on the wind-up where you were like, I'd take you on an alley and kick you or something? Took it back.
Take her
resurrect
on the alley.
That and add bullets. No, I just absolutely adore Astro's Playroom. I think it's absolutely immaculate. And I think that, as much as I can point to these other games that do have all these intrinsic qualities, all these different things, they're obviously bigger games.
Yeah.
But if I'm going to go in a whole soapbox for a second, I think we get too hung up on production quality and budget quality and project size as an indicator of quality, and we go, well, that can't be a number two because look at it, it's so much smaller than Horizon. It doesn't matter. If it's immaculate, it's immaculate, and that's what they aimed for and they nailed it.
I mean, I, again, I kind of agree. I don't think you should look at the production budget of a game or its size and be like, this is more deserving because it's bigger.
I'm not saying you were saying that either. But
oh, no, totally. But Astro Man, like, it's lovely, it's impeccable, but it is a tech demo.
So was PT, that was the best game of 2014.
But PT is nowhere to be seen.
It's not, to be honest. I was going to have it as an honourable mention, and then I forgot to put it down. But PT would be in there somewhere. Anyway, what's your number two?
My number two was Death Stranding, which we've
very
talked
nice,
about.
Very nice, very nice.
Very good.
We should jump to number ones then, because mine has to be God of War.
And mine has to be The Last of Us Part Two,
which is very, very funny, considering that it's me and you. I'll very quickly do God of War, because we touched on that before. Which is just to say that God of War just was this culmination of the studio themselves. Like, obviously, Corey Barlog came on board with God of War 2. And I think he helped out on God of War 1. But there was the whole thing where the reason God of War is just this, it elevates in so many different ways, is because it is this living commentary on violence in video games and immaturity in video games and the different trends that we were all into across the 2000s that someone like Kratos used to embody. Like, just like, to quote Doom, like, rip and tear everything apart, the sexism, the brutality, the violence. It worked for the time, whatever line you want to use, but I feel like that studio have matured so much, and Corey Barlog, having been there from the beginning, wrote this incredible reframing of that character, this version of Kratos that is old and withered and broken and doesn't think he deserves love and struggles to even put a hand on his son's shoulder, a son who isn't even his, I don't think. I think it's the person he's with, Freya's son, and just the way they reframe and recontextualize that whole character, that he's quite remorseful for his past. It was at the very beginning when he's cutting the tree down, you realize that it's to build a fire because his wife's died, or his partner's died, and he's actually covering up the chain marks with the bandages. Even that made me teary. And it's not that I loved the original game so much. I thought God of War 3 was the tipping point where they were too brutal and too gory and too stupid. But it's because if you grew up with video games, or you cared about violent video games, and you love all those things, and it's not like I don't love those games, like Mortal Kombat or whatever, there's something about the way that they do old man regrets his past that I just think they nailed that vibe so much, and it's all they do so much with it. Like, violence serves a purpose. Like, he has to re-embrace his worst side to go into hell and retrieve a certain item, and when he gets the Blades of Chaos back and he's like crying, and it's like, it's just insane. But there's a power there, and there's fun to that violence, and I'm like, they do for violence and portrayals of violence and controllable violence what Uncharted does for adventures and risk taking and platforming and stuff like that. It's like, once you ground these characters, then everything that came beforehand is only elevated. And so God of War 2018 is a masterpiece to me, and it has infinite conversations around it for the past of video games, the present video games, and obviously the future as well.
The thing is, I can only agree. Like, everything you said, fully agree. It's partly why I love it as well. All of its comments on, you know, video game violence, like you mentioned, the way it reframes Kratos' history.
All the stuff with Atreus being a little douche.
Yeah, like,
it's like, that's what it would be like if you had to take care of your old self.
100%. I love the way that they spin, you know, the entitlement of the gods, which was an entire part of the previous trilogy, but it's here when, as soon as Atreus finds out that he is, you know, of godly heritage, he starts treating people terribly. And Kratos is like, I have no idea how to deal with this because I'm not really a father. You know, I am a father in the terms of, you know, I am this guy, I am this boy's dad, but I don't understand how to steer him off this path. And having Kratos be responsible for that, and for him to see his former self in his son, in what he could become, literally, you know, taking down an entire mythology like Kratos did in God of War 3, I love those parts. That's something I want to see explored more in Ragnarok, because I think as Atreus ages and becomes potentially more like Kratos, who wants him to be more like his mother, that friction there is going to
and like all the
be
stuff,
more pronounced.
Yeah, all the stuff with like Atreus sort of looking up to Kratos to some degree, and like he's being taught to be a warrior, but at the end Kratos just says, you need to be better. It's like, the one thing you need to be is you need to be better than what I was. And then in 2, it seems like they're seeding the whole idea that as Atreus gets older, he gets annoyed that Kratos won't fight more, and it's like, that's a brilliant extrapolation or extension of that conversation. And so yeah, there's infinite things I love about God of War. Your number one, though, is Last of Us 2. You should talk about why that is your number one.
The Last of Us Part 2, probably similar to what you like about God of War, for instance, is just the way it handles, you know, video game violence, I guess. You know, the way it reframes the original story. I know that's very controversial for a lot of people who didn't want to see the likes of Joel be minimized in the story. But the way that they handle and continue a story that I thought was complete in myself when I finished The Last of Us 1. I was just like, you don't need to do another one. When they announced the sequel, I was kind of trepidatious and I was thinking, is this going to ruin what the original accomplished? To me, it's one of those rare sequels that took a risk and managed to pull it off. You know, I do think that the risks it takes by introducing a second playable character and splitting the narrative into two, for me, it all works and it added to something that was more than just The Last of Us 2. This feels like a part two. It doesn't feel like more of The Last of Us, which would have satisfied a lot of people, probably would have satisfied me.
Same.
But just the way it you know, reframes that story, puts a character that you love in Ellie and Joel, it makes them uglier, makes them more three-dimensional, makes them more complex, to me is exactly what I want from video game storytelling. I don't want it to be as cut and dry, and I don't like subversion for subversion's sake. You know, I don't like Game of Thrones' final season because of how much the writers, which is dedicated to surprising people, but for me, those surprises are earned in the sequel.
I will totally say that when, spoilers for The Last of Us 2, you probably already know, when Joel dies, I was so happy, not because he died, but because it meant I had no idea where this was going.
Yeah.
And that feeling is so rare, especially in mass entertainment. I loved in that moment just going like, oh my God, what have you guys written?
Yeah.
What have you written to justify this entire sequel? We're only like an hour in. That feeling was just so palpable and I loved it. For me, I'm not going to go on about the negatives. We've done so many podcasts on The Last of Us 2. It was just that, and it's not that I didn't love my time with it. As I was playing it, I was like, animation-wise and playability-wise and scripting, Ashley Johnson, give her all the awards. Yeah. Obviously, Laura Bailey as Abby as well. But yeah, Ashley Johnson as Ellie, phenomenal acting. And the little bits and pieces you get of Troy Baker as Joel too. But it was just that feeling of like, I can't shake the reality of what my brain said to me when I hit the credits, which was just, I don't think I needed that.
Right, yeah.
And it's not that its depiction of brutal violence isn't incredible and so poignant and punchy, and it really sticks with you, and it's visceral as hell. I just personally... that's not the Last of Us sequel I wanted. And so if we're doing completely subjective lists, it's just an honorable mention. It is a 5-star game. It is incredible. The production value is insane. I also just have a bit of an issue with the almost Austin Powers-ish. What if that goon had a family? Like, I couldn't shake that as an overall narrative structure thing.
Right.
But that's not to say that they don't do their absolute utmost to justify it.
Yeah.
But to stick to the positives, yeah, the combat's immaculate, the way they blend all the animations, which is kind of, no one really talks about how stellar the combat is.
Yes.
Like, you can chain everything together in one big natural motion.
Oh my God, you can get lost on YouTube videos or Twitter clips of people perfecting that combat system, and it looks incredibly cinematic. Like, the way you can chain those combos together,
shout
like
out
you
to
said,
Sunny Legend
is
on
so bloody good. And I was replaying those combat scenarios just because I wanted more of the combat.
Same.
I thought, you've elevated this. You know, Naughty Dog games are often criticized for the combat mechanics not being as good as the story, and I think with The Last of Us 2, there's a sense of cinematic fluidity to it alongside a general sense of kind of viscerality from your own inputs that just makes it feel good to play in a way that some of their other games, including The Last of Us 1, in my opinion, wasn't quite there yet. This plays well. I think the story backs it up. And it's funny, you know, you mentioned about the things that you didn't necessarily want from the sequel. Mm. There's a lot of stuff in there that I didn't think I wanted.
Right.
But I think where we might differ is that every time I play The Last of Us 1, I was always thinking about Joel and how his actions were perceived. In fact, I've even written something about, is Joel the villain of The Last of Us?
I think you did.
Yeah, something like that. Because I was always fascinated with how, you know, if you weren't Ellie, if you weren't the player, how the hell would you see this guy? This effing kind of brutal, you know, survive at all cost man who only cares about the people he loves. And for me, them answering that question, or at least interrogating that question, was just open the world up in a way that I wanted the first one to do. And I don't know, man. You know, we talk a lot on this podcast about having those video game stories where something comes out and we talk about them on podcasts and it dominates the discourse, and how few of those we have now. I like that people don't like The Last of Us Part 2.
Right.
I like that there are good discussions to be had. Obviously, I don't like the bad faith stuff. That's
no, I know what you mean. Yeah.
But me and you talking about this, you know, like, that's cool that we have a story of this caliber, because it must be doing something right.
Yes.
If we can disagree with it or pick it apart to this level, not not just that, not just in terms of, I think the villain sucks, I think the end was kind of weak. You know what I mean? Like, the real conversations to be had.
Oh, man, absolutely. Like, I mean, when was the last time we had a really complex character to pick apart? And there's no one, like, Naughty Dog do it better than anyone else. And it's like, yeah, those are the things that I absolutely love. I also think that, obviously, Neil Druckmann said that he framed the whole thing around hate. Like, if the original game's theme was about love, then this one is all about hate. And I think, again, it's one of the things that barely gets talked about because all the discourse around Last of Us 2 is entirely in the Joel stuff. But it is in how they frame this whole world of how hate comes through in the micro and the macro, whether it's a human-on-human disagreement or an altercation or like a revenge story, but also in the fact that in the post-apocalypse you have like the military is coming back and there's religion is coming back and all these different judgment systems are coming back and all these different confrontational systems are coming back. Hate is in us, like, to some degree. And I think that they don't necessarily go into that on the nose, but it's there. Like, it frames the world, and I think like that should be celebrated so much more. Like, yeah, Last of Us 2 has again, you can argue like infinite conversations that come out of it. It's just, for me, it wasn't what I wanted from a Last of Us sequel, but that's not to say that it's not stellar. I think that more time, as time passes, it'll only serve it better.
Yeah.
Especially if they do end up doing a Last of Us Part 3, and you can kind of look at it as this dipping into different characters thing rather than Last of Us is Joel and Ellie.
Yeah.
I think that might be something that works better over time.
I agree.
Yes. Now, so to run down, 10-1 for me is Final Fantasy VII Remake, Until Dawn, The Last Guardian, Sifu, Spider-Man / Miles Morales, Horizon Zero Dawn, Death Stranding, Ghost of Tsushima, Astro's Goddamn Playroom, and God of War, JB.
Mine is 10-1, Uncharted 4, Until Dawn, Horizon Forbidden West, Ghost of Tsushima, Returnal, Spider-Man, God of War, Bloodborne, Death Stranding, and The Last of Us Part 2.
Those are tasty rankings,
Yours are too, my friend.
Those are very tasty rankings in a very delicious way. Now, yes, this has been the... this has not been the Untitled Band Podcast
it
at all.
It hasn't.
This has been the What Culture Gaming Podcast. Thank you all very much for listening. A bit of an extra long one, because we had a lot to talk about, and we're going to do more, comparison, rivalry type stuff, usually on the wind-up for me and your podcast that we do on a Monday. But massive thank you to everybody for listening. For now, this has been the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I have been your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Tilford.
And we'll catch you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.